first half, second half, like chalk and cheese.
That can't be my best bet, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together. Putting the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome back to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We are coming to you on the evening of Monday, April 29th, 2019, our most probably last podcast of April 2019. Rabbi Mark Goodman, how are you doing this evening, my friend?
They're the greatest team the world has ever seen, and it's Fulham. Fulham.
Matt went to Fulham. And Arsenal, and how many other, what other teams did you see while you were there, Matt? Matt just got back from England.
Yes, so I took off Friday, or Wednesday, excuse me, after work, landed mid-morning, like 9:30 on Thursday. Went to the hotel, which was just about a 10-minute walk from Victoria Station in the main downtown, kind of touristy, but also close to some significant government building stuff. The parental units who were joining me on the trip weren't getting in until later in the day. We were going to go have some high tea and then go see a show afterwards. So I spent some time in Chelsea over at Stamford Bridge, where I took a tour of Stamford Bridge, sat in the shed end. Had a fantastic British guide named Charlie. And so when you actually go to the tour mark at Stamford Bridge, you start off in the Chelsea Museum. They recommend getting there about 20 minutes early. I ended up going up into the museum, pretty interactive. They had a cool little PK shootout area, and then they had targets on all of the areas of the goal, and they had different point values, and it was increasing in value. And if you shot, they had a little soccer ball there, a football. An 18-point ball, actually. And so if you hit the target, it would light up, and then it would show a screen of the penalty kick taken by the Chelsea player in the Champions League final against Bayern Munich. And then the most points would have been the slightly upper right part of the lower right-hand corner that was worth 100 points. And if you hit that, it showed the video overlay of Didier Drogba scoring the penalty kick that was ultimately the championship winner, and then the ensuing celebration. So that was cool and interactive. A bunch of really good history on Stamford Bridge. I was the only native English speaker on the tour, and so they gave out video headsets, and then that translated all of the talk that he was having that was kind of just the banter stuff about the history that was very scripted. And then the rest of the tour is literally him saying, hey, we're the only two English speakers, let's banter about stuff. I was, of course, wearing LA Galaxy stuff because it was somewhat similar to the Chelsea gear, so we were bantering off and on about Steven Gerrard and all the times that he came to Stamford Bridge and was very, very unsuccessful. We talked about David Beckham, you know, he commented on, never had much pace. He was all right on free kicks, I guess. And then as soon as we got down, we go to the field level. We get to sit where Sarre sits and where the players sit. No going on the field, obviously. But then we go into the press conference, and immediately I go into journo mode, Mark, and I'm asking him as if it's Mauricio Sarri after a win for Chelsea about the performance thing and everything. The press situation that you have at both Stamford Bridge and the Emirates is far better than anything we ever got or we'll get at Dick's Sporting Park, Mark, and I'm going to assume it's far superior to anything you get at Highmark Stadium covering the Riverhounds of the USL. So Stamford Bridge, and then going to the Chelsea Pensioner, where they have a cat that lives there at the pub, was my Thursday before the parents showed up. Friday was all going down to Worthing to see the great uncle, who is doing very, very well for his age. And then Saturday was pretty much all football. My dad and I get up, proper English breakfast, and then we head on over to your favorite place, the Emirates, do the equivalent, for Arsenal. Got to see the Invincibles trophy, a really nice bust of, of Arsene Wenger. I would say the press situation at the Emirates is much, much better than Chelsea's. The tour guides both said, Mark, that they average for a standard Premier League game on a Saturday, they get about 100 total media members between video, between like the local TV stations, Video International, sure. And then also written stuff. Do you want to guess, Mark, what's the most number of journalists who have ever showed up to a game at the Emirates?
I would go with 500, or maybe they don't give passes over 250.
It was 246, and they actually made an assumption. Normally, they cap it off at 200 for all the games that they have. And that was for the final home game of the season. For the Invincibles season. The Invincibles had already, clinched the trophy at that point, but that result was officially clinching the full year, undefeated in all league competitions. And I believe that also set a record for the club in terms of longest home streak, undefeated in all competition that would have broken some record set, back in the 50s, I think, when the club was still at Highbury. You know, we run over to the train, to the tube, excuse me. We get very, very lucky, in that we catch the tube that has us not have to do two transfers that ultimately had us land off at Hammersmith. Did stop by at the Dennis Bergkamp statue, and then the Thierry Henry, did a couple good photo shoots there with similarly, you know, the double knee slide for Thierry Henry. I'm not quite as flexible enough to do the Bergkamp touching the ball down on the first touch from the ball overloading, but I did the vocal and the facial expression of the the Dutch commentator for that World Cup that he scored after the three Dennis Bergkamps, and then I won't try to intimidate the "Aloo!" Like I did whatever the face you make when that comes out of your mouth for him scoring the goal for the Netherlands, I believe, against Argentina. And then it was off to the Crabtree, which is one of the local pubs, just three blocks away from Craven Cottage. Spent a bunch of time taking pictures outside, went to ticket collect to collect my paper tickets because Craven Cottage is very old-timey. Had a nice £8 for a pub and a pie. At halftime, had an absolute blast in the Hammersmith End, took a whole bunch of pictures. I snuck into the main stand, Mark, which is was built in 1906. It's the oldest main stand in all of the English Premier League, almost no additions to it, and then most of the wood seats that they have there in the upper deck are originals going back in 1906, so I took a seat down in there, which was really, really cool. It had a very, I imagine a baseball fan making their first homage to Wrigley Field, having the similar types of jitters, or, you know, say going to a Fenway Park, for example. And there were a lot of aspects, culturally in tradition and how the club operated things that you just, I know for a fact have not changed for another generation. And that there are a couple of small little things. Obviously there's technological necessities and the fact that the ground, you know, was only seating 5,000 people in 1906 that haven't changed much since then. So in a lot of ways, it's a nice time capsule to old timey English football and being a proper neighborhood family football club that was very, very interesting and, romanticized in ways that you can't really do that when you've got foreign billionaire owners who are tearing down grounds that have existed for 100 years and building these fancy new stadiums that don't remember everything and the corporate influx that you see at some of the other clubs and certainly, you know, the two clubs in Manchester and certainly, you know, the Real Madrids and the Bayern Munichs of the world that, you know, Fulham has chosen to maintain that history, and the current ownership has chosen to maintain that. And yes, they're going down, you know, down in the Championship, probably bringing Cardiff along with them with the 1-0 result that they had on Saturday. But, you know, you could tell from the picture that I posted afterwards and everything afterwards that, Mark, I was just, I had forgotten what it's like to go to a soccer game and have a team that I care about watch them and see them get a win and do it in emphatic form. Right. And I was just absolutely electric after that. And I just, you know, immediately I struck up a conversation with anybody, and immediately they know that I'm not from Fulham or London or England because of the accent. And of course I say I'm an American, and, you know, I bring up The Great Escape and everything. And I just have to name drop Clint Dempsey, and immediately I was absolutely accepted. So I made a lot of really, really good friends. I like Fulham Twitter is now following me because my post about the game like went semi-viral. So to Josh, season ticket member of H4, that's the section number 4 on the Hammersmith end, to David and his father Daniel, who were at the game against Juventus where Clint Dempsey scored the greatest goal in Fulham history. It was a pleasure speaking with you and interacting with you and changing contact info. And I very much look forward to my second game at Craven Cottage, Mark, whether it's in the Premier League or not.
It's amazing. Sounds like you had a great trip. And I think one of the things that you did right there was kind of give a basic travelogue of like things people might want to do while they're in England. What did you eat briefly? Tell me a couple of British delicacies that you enjoyed.
Proper English breakfast. I tried Bovril for the first time. That was absolutely terrible. It's like a meaty, salty sauce spread. You put it on toast.
And it's not good to jam.
Most people have a love-hate relationship to it. Like, they either love it or they absolutely hate it. I've tried marmalade before, and I absolutely love marmalade even before reading all the Paddington books and then seeing the recent movies that have come out. So I like citrus flavors naturally, so I really like marmalade. All the little cakes and the scones that we had with high tea was really, really good. Best two beers that my dad and I had. Anything you can get that's London Pride was absolutely fantastic. They have a lager, they have a stout, and an IPA that are usually the stuff they have on tap at most bars. Those were excellent. And then the Camden, they have a lager, a light lager, and then an IPA were also excellent. So I highly recommend those. But I mean, you know, it's England. You ask for any local beer, and you know it was going to be fine. It was kind of funny. I went into the Chelsea Pensioner, and the barkeep didn't even notice me. He's like, oh, sit wherever you want. You know, here's a menu. I asked a couple questions. You know, he said, oh, so you're not from England. Where are you from? He's like, oh, I'm originally from California, but I live in Colorado. You know, all I had to say was the mountains, and he knew roughly where I was talking about geographically. In the United States, it's like, oh, well, do you want to something to drink or something? And he reaches for the Bud Light tab, and I say, give me the best local thing that you have that people have here on match day. And then so he immediately just brought me a London Pride, and so I asked him about it, and that was fantastic. The pies, you can't really go wrong. Anything with mash, they have all kind of meat options. There was a mushroom and asparagus one I had at the Chelsea Pensioner was absolutely fantastic. You know, it's good, and if you're a carb loader, you will be well fed for a reasonable price anywhere you go in London.
Yeah, and I could eat that one too, the mushroom asparagus. That sounds good. I kind of want a recipe for that, but I'm sure if I Google around enough, I can find something that probably won't taste nearly as good. So I'll give it a try.
Probably. All right. Any other questions you have on my being a smug holiday fiend this weekend, Mark?
Did you go to a show or no? Your parents went to the show.
I went to the show with them. I don't know how. My mom is a super sleuth when it comes to travel stuff. If she ever decides to stop being, head of an accounting department at the current company that she's working at, like she could totally be like an independent contractor as a travel agent. Like if you were planning like a honeymoon and you wanted to keep it to like $1,500 for doing like Paris and like Prague over the course of a week, like she could absolutely make that happen. So she knew who to talk to from the last travel agency had when my dad and her went to London a couple years ago, and they saw Phantom of the Opera. She was aware of last minute ticket sales for the upper level to go see Hamilton at the Apollo Theater, and so she scored that like 3-4 days beforehand just because she hit the timing right. So we ended up going to see Hamilton. It was my first time seeing it. I've seen the recordings and the soundtrack from the Broadway production. Definitely, you know, not as good as what they're doing up there with Broadway with I can't remember the name of the actor with the ponytail off the top of my head. His name's escaping me for some reason, who plays Hamilton, and he's in the Chase commercial. I'm totally blanking. We're going to get angry tweets about me not knowing him, but it was a pretty good rendition. it's weird for me from a cultural standpoint, because you think of London of being this extreme diverse melting pot. And I think from my experience, maybe this is me growing up in, white suburban America bubble, but I think about, I hear a London British accent or a British accent in general and immediately think somebody white. So then to, understand that I'm in London where I could see, a Middle Eastern person or an Indian person, or someone of color, and then, somewhere in the Commonwealth or a place that England historically had roots in its colonization period, and knowing in my head they can have a proper British accent, but then also going and like having, a black iteration of Thomas Jefferson and a black iteration of Alexander Hamilton doing a rap battle about the Federal Reserve is an amazing cultural experience, and to have that in the context of knowing these are all British accents and they all talk like, they all talk like Adrian Healy is just an extremely, I'm seeing something, I'm hearing something, and it doesn't inherently compute, and it's a fantastic cultural experience. I'd highly recommend Hamilton regardless of where you're seeing it in the world, friends.
Yeah. Well, according to Playbill, the London cast of Hamilton has Jamel Westman as the lead, but he does not have a ponytail. So you may have been thinking of Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yes, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Thank you very much.
He's the originator. Mark. He wasn't in your cast, unless you got really lucky, which is
No, we did not. It was an all British local cast. It wasn't a traveling group, and to my knowledge, nobody, at least on the stage cast, was.
Well, my problem is my whole family, well, not my whole family, but my son loves Hamilton, so I exposed him to it, and then Hamilton came to Pittsburgh, but I couldn't go with just Iggy, because then I'd leave out my daughter and my wife, and my daughter's only 6, so she can't go, Mm-hmm. So I'm a huge fan. I know all the music, like, pretty much by heart. So I just have to wait another year or two till my whole family can do it, but also I have to save the money. So, just putting a couple, putting 10 bucks away a week, and, in 10 or so years, I'll have enough money to go to Hamilton.
Yeah, fantastic. I would say if anybody has any questions who's planning a London football trip at all or anything, feel free to reach out to me. My DMs are open on Twitter. You can get us on the email as well. Pretty much every single stadium, at least that we passed, was accessible via the tube with relative ease. Most of them have a direct stop. If it's not named after the club, it's within reasonable walking distance, and it's where everybody knows. Certainly if for some reason, you're an Arsenal fan and you're in London and you didn't plan it when Arsenal was playing a game, I think certainly the tour options they have available are flexible, easy to plan a week out, are at a reasonable cost, and are definitely worth the value in terms of the behind the scenes, experience.
Great. So I think that's it. Thanks, listeners, for hearing about our podcast of how to travel to London on a limited amount of money and our review of Hamilton. Check in next week. You can catch us on Patreon. Matt writes for Last Word on Soccer. I write for the Denver Post. See you later.
All right, Mark, let's get to it. Listeners, Saturday.
We can't talk about the Colorado Rapids. I don't want to talk about domestic soccer. That's no fun. We had a nice podcast going till now.
Okay, well.
Happy.
Okay, well, Mark, like that Keegan Rosenberry outlet pass, I'm going to completely ruin the result for us here.
Oh my God, that was bad.
Okay, listeners, this past Saturday at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, for the first time ever, the Colorado Rapids were again defeated by Atlanta United FC by a score of 1-0. Full disclosure, listeners, I did not watch this game live because, appearance out, Mark, one bad side of going to England to go watch a bunch of soccer is that the Watch ESPN app and everything with ESPN Plus is blacked out in the UK. So it would have required some cavaliering on the dark web or, some serious VPN work that is above my skill set in order to try and accomplish this. And I didn't want to watch the game through Twitter because it was 11 p.m. I just finished up my postcards and I had to get up at 6 to go to the airport. But I woke up, I don't know why, but something in my brain had me wake up and think, did I wake up in the middle of the night and see 1-0 Rapids? Like, did I dream that Kai Kamara scored a worldie from 40 yards out? So I woke up and for some reason, I felt really positive and I thought that the Rapids had won 1-0. And I checked my phone and I see that it was a Julian Gressel goal in the 74th minute. of an assist by Darlington Nagbe on a poor pass by Keegan Rosenberry. I have since gone back and watched the condensed highlights, Mark, and honestly, this was a dud. Like, the Rapids had a couple really good moments in the first half in terms of just getting the ball into a good position with numbers. Didn't really do anything with it. You know, Atlanta had 15 shots in this game, but most of them were half chances. This should have been a 0-0 draw. And I think if it were like, you can, in any other scenario, home or away against a remotely competent team in MLS, both of these teams are losing this game. You had three yellow cards to Colorado Rapids players. You know, maybe the one saving grace in terms of, you know, the experience was, Sebastian Anderson started his first start in MLS, got, you know, 80 minutes. I think a relatively okay performance, all things considered. I don't know what was going on in terms of this lineup and in terms of this roster decision. Mark, we've got bigger things to talk about that happened outside the 90 minutes. Let's start with just very briefly. Did you have any good takeaways from this match?
Yeah, I did. I actually really liked this match, for a couple reasons. One, and hardcore listeners are either going to be start throwing things at their radios, or some of you might actually, you know me well enough from my writing and what I've said on the podcast before to kind of anticipate this. But like, I like a good defensive outlook, and I also like it when a coach shows they've got more than one trick in their up their sleeve. So one thing I was frustrated with a couple weeks ago, I think, that I mentioned was that Anthony Hudson was not pragmatic when he went on the road. That when he went on the road, he more or less came out in the same way that he did at home. This game, I think Anthony Hudson did a good thing, which was create a bunker and counter, highly defensive lineup, and then roll it out. Now, say what you will about putting Danny Wilson in the middle of the pitch as a defensive midfielder. Say what you will about starting two teenagers at the wingback positions while benching Dylan Serna, who got his 100th appearance, but it was in relief. Say what you will about rolling out Tommy Smith again, but also say what you will about benching basically three quarters of the entire midfield as Benny Fellhaber, Cole Bassett, and Jack Price all got sat
down.
Jack
Price suspended for the red card last week.
Yes, thank you. Ah, very good. I'm glad you reminded me of that. It came so late. But I liked the way they played. I thought they played 45 good minutes of football as the game crept in. I did watch this game live. As the game crept into the second half, I think I had the same sense of dread that most fans did, which was Atlanta was pinning them back more and more and more, and Colorado was looking less and less counterattacking, and it looked like there was a point around, you know, the 55th or 60th minute where I was like, the dam is going to break. We're just going to crack at this point. But if they can get back to where they were in the first half, there's a chance here. And they didn't. You know, they cracked in the 74th, and that was that. So, the good thing is that I liked that Anthony Hudson gambled on a different look. I liked that they were pragmatic on the road, and I thought that the team was okay defensively, despite the fact that the defenders have a reputation this season of being pretty lousy. They still kept Joseph Martinez off the board all game, and they frustrated Pity Martinez enough that the dude hit the bench and started kicking the chair, and Breck Shea had to, like, you know, stroke his forehead and serve him some warm milk to get him to calm down. So that's a win for us on some level. Matt, what was anything good from you?
I'm going to go with Sam Nicholson, you know, getting a start, playing, I think, a pretty solid 64th minute. You know, the sub, subbing him out, you know, I thought was mostly a tactical decision and wanting to change things up. But, you know, there wasn't, you know, yes, the team gave up a goal. Yes, it was on a mistake by Keegan Rosenberry, but it wasn't, you know, I agree with your sentiment that there was, you know, that they got back to basics in terms of things defensively, and, you know, this was a minor flesh wound that ultimately led to the result, as opposed to, you know, a fully amputated and outward bleeding, you know, appendage, so to speak. And so in that, there wasn't, you know, a woeful defensive performance from anyone from the goalkeeper position to the back three to the back five, depending on how you wanted it. You know, I thought Sam Vines looked reasonably comfortable given all things going on with him, and at times he had to mark up against Julian Gressel, you know, for a first start ever in a very, very hostile environment on a team that had been playing poorly. You know, the fact that Sebastian Anderson didn't single-handedly lose the game in the first 45 minutes was decent. He put in a good shift, you know, in 80 minutes. And, you know, Tommy Smith didn't have, you know, he didn't have a single play that, you know, you would result in turning, you know, that an opposing fan or member of the or, you know, member of the communication social media team is turning into a gif for a highlight reel of one of the fantastic plays by one of their attacking players. You know, last thing I'll say, you know, I have been skeptical the last three or four times it's happened where Diego Rubio has been moved into some wide midfield role, winger role, you know, anything where he's not lining up directly with and underneath. Kai Kamara started out on the left and was mostly there, for the entirety of the game, and I thought he did pretty well in terms of the link-up play. You know, he had one opportunity where he was trying to, excuse me, to collect the ball just outside the box, and he tries to toe poke it down and ends up trying to nutmeg the defender on him. This would have been in the second half, I believe, and he just wasn't able to control it. But, you know, a month ago I would have said, you know, I would have gone to Anthony Hudson and said, Gaffer, you know, what are you thinking putting Rubio out wide? And I think Rubio's shown enough of a skill set, commitment and effort to where I'm not thinking of that as an absolute disaster. There are other positional decisions he's had in terms of where he's lined up players in the midfield and elsewhere to where I have issues. If the tactics and the game plan and what the team wants to do necessitate Kai Kamara being a lone forward up top, I am not opposed to Diego Rubio playing out in a wide midfield role, preferably on going upfield. It would be his left, so Kai Kamara playing his back to goal and facing towards Tim Howard. It would be Kai Kamara's right. I'm not opposed to him lining up there, where I think previously I would have thought, you know, lining up Diego Rubio anywhere other than second striker is an absolute disaster and an indication of a lack of tactical acumen from the coaching staff as far as personnel decisions are made. Mark, let's go to bad things. You know, any big or noticeable things other than what we've agreed upon is the big thing coming out of this match?
It was really simple. They lost. They didn't generate all that much offense. They were looking to go in and get a 0-0 draw, and they didn't. And, you know, this is a results-oriented game, Alexi Lalas likes to say. It's the ninth not win for the Rapids to start the season, which makes them one of only three teams in MLS to go that long without getting a win. If they get one more game without a win, they move into second place. The only team, the 2012 Toronto team had 9 losses before they booked a win in their 10th match. The only team that has more non-wins or has gone winless as in more games beyond Toronto is the 2007 Real Salt Lake team that went 11 games without a win. But that team, so Toronto lost all of their first 9 games, which the Rapids have not done that. So at least we're sort of better than that. But on the other hand, RSL, they had a worse, they went 11 games without a win. But on the other hand, they had 5 losses and 6 draws, whereas Colorado has 7 losses and 2 draws. So this is a bad start, and it's just about, you know, it's about finding a way to get the result, and they don't. And I don't know, you know, at this point, there are definitely tactical questions to be asked, personnel questions to be asked, and mental questions to be asked about whether when you're in a downward spiral as a team and you don't have a lot of confidence, whether you can figure out a way to change the paradigm and go in and find a way to win. You know, going home helps this week. And playing Vancouver, who aren't great, but they're not bad either, should be, you know, there should be some advantages, but, you know, this team is in a bad way, and we'll talk about one other way in which they're in a really bad way. Matt, you have any other bad things?
I mean, I'll agree with you that, you know, yes, the performance was better. Yes, they managed the result. And, you know, ultimately I think the scoreline didn't flatter them, but certainly I think the number of goals that they conceded, did in terms of the performance, but, you know, ultimately it's still, you know, it's horseshoes and hand grenades, and that's not how the beautiful game ends up working. You know, it's about results, and it's ultimately about getting the ball in the back of the net and keeping the ball out of your net. And whether it was, you know, four goals against Houston or two against Seattle or one against Atlanta, the fact is they didn't do that. And, you know, I'm quoting, you know, the old Oozeworm, you know, Burgundy Wave recap from back in the day of, you know, the Rapids lose to other MLS team who scores many goals to their fewer goals. So, you know, this team still has, they've conceded 24 goals on the season. No team in MLS after them has conceded more than 19. And this is still a team that is on pace to be statistically one of the worst defenses by a number of metrics in the history of MLS, and they've yet to get a clean sheet. And the other teams that have still given up a lot of goals have found a way to get a bunch of other goals, or, you know, it's been circumstantial, you know, one little blip, you know, where San Jose gets a red card in the first half and they lose 5-0 to, you know, to LAFC. You know, the Galaxy the Rapids haven't had one of those games where they've just been absolutely shellacked and not been in it, really, other than the Houston game. You know, they can't, you know, this is, it's still a consistent problem. They can't say that it was one blip, you know, where they had three games in 8 days and a bunch of injuries and just got blown out. This team consistently cannot keep the opponent out of the back of the net or get a clean sheet and have a solid defensive performance over the course of the 90 minutes. And as long as they're going to do that and continue to commit more and more energy to the defensive side of the ball, further starving Kai Kamara of opportunities it doesn't matter if you lose 1-0 or you lose 5-4. 5-4 is more exciting. You feel a little bit better about the offense, but, you know, the standings and the math behind it doesn't really count. And in that, you know, they haven't really made any changes. All right, Mark. Let's get to the big thing. For those of you who've been living under a rock, have not read anything from Alicia Rodriguez over at MLSsoccer.com, or seen the various banter in the aftermath on Twitter, Anthony Hudson came out absolutely spitting fire in his post-game press conference. We have seen a trend in the last couple of games, going back to some of the questions that I have asked him. I would say that the media, rightfully so, both Rapids Press Corps, general MLS Press Corps, and just general members of the media who have interacted with Hudson have been pressing him a little bit more consistently on why the results aren't going well, and in particular, the defensive issues and how the team goes about addressing those issues. In his first year at the helm of the Colorado Rapids, he was typically very, very reserved. He hesitated to criticize players either individually or collectively. You usually had to ask about a specific player either in a negative context or a positive context for him to really give you the obvious compliment, canned quote that you were maybe asking for from a good performance, or the opposite for a poor performance or a poor play that ultimately led to a goal. And he has been more outspoken about the defense not performing well, about tactical issues and then trying to address that, and still the individual performances and the collective performance of the group not being good, regardless of what they're doing tactically, and individual mistakes ultimately costing this team, and ultimately, particularly the defenders, needing to play better, and then ultimately just being very, very poor. He had a number of very, very spicy quotes out of the interview that he had that would have been with the Rapids radio commentator and Jane of all media trades, Jordan Angeli, and then our colleague from the Burgundy Wave, Abby Mood, made the trip out to Atlanta and asked him a couple questions after there, and they were still more of the same. And Hudson kind of went a little Bob Bradley in this one, Mark, where he kind of, you know, took the question and then put a spin on it and kind of went in another direction and tried to, you know, rather than just make the post-game interview about him answering the questions of what the media members wanted, really trying to make a statement. He was, you know, very flat out and open to the fact that, you know, Atlanta has a lot of talent, and there's a lot of these other teams that are very, very talented, and they're just, that they've got better players, and they're more, you know, well-baked in terms of their plan and the evolution and the development of their tactics than the Rapids are right now. And he said a number of times that it was a long rebuild. I want to say he kind of threw some shade at some of the hot takes, and maybe people like you and me, Mark, who, you know, aren't commenting as much about the gap in talent that the Rapids are maybe having to deal with, or how things are just taking longer, or just the realities of what expectations should be in the context of where the Rapids are compared to the Atlantas, the Torontos, you know, the teams that have players that cost many, many millions, and the individual players who can win a game for you. where the Rapids don't have, I think, a single one of those players. You know, maybe there's still flashes from yesteryear from Kai Kamara, but you know, there's nobody offensively you can single-handedly just give the ball to and say, you can't, there's nobody on the Rapids who the offensive plan can be get them the ball and then they'll find a way to get the Rapids a win. If nothing else, the Portland Timbers have that in Diego Valeri. You would think that Atlanta would have that in Joseph Martinez. You would think that, you know, that, Toronto FC has that in Pozuelo and the now engaged Jozy Altidore. The Rapids don't have that in attack, and the Rapids don't have that in defense. They don't have a Walker Zimmerman who can single-handedly organize a ragtag backline and get them organized. They don't have Air Marshall who can shut down everything in the air. So they don't have a talisman on either side of the ball. They have a collectively a weaker team, a team that in Hudson's mind has a lot of defensive issues and has a lot of things that are going to take a little bit of time, and in his mind, people heaping on a whole bunch of criticism on a team that's still working on their problems for a team that finished almost near the bottom of the Western Conference the year before he got there and is dealing with some contracts that frankly aren't that productive in the field. Skel Shangashi no longer with the team. Tim Howard very much a marketing, a PR, a shirt sponsor move. You know, for the production that he's giving you at goalkeeper, he's not giving you a $2.4 million goalkeeper production compared to others in the league. And hypothetically speaking, there are other DPs in MLS who are making in excess of about $2.5 million, who are fantastic for their clubs and are that offensive number 10 or number 9 talisman, and the Rapids could in theory have that, but they don't. And he was deflecting a little bit. He was being a little bit defensive, and he had a lot of very interesting quotes. Mark, talk us through some of the things that he said, and how do we go about annotating and making sense of where Anthony Hudson's headspace is right now?
Yeah, so the big money quote that everybody is seizing on more than anybody else, Sam Stachel retweeted it, and it's, you can find it on the Alicia Rodriguez's article, and also the original video is up at the top, and his really spicy quote started about 3 minutes. So here's the first one. We are fighting at the bottom with a bottom group of players, and we have to find a way to pick up results whilst being a team that tries to play a certain way, and we just have to find that balance. So that's one. And then the next one, which is a big one, is a little bit about, so that's to your point, Matt, throwing some of the players under the bus. And then the next one is a little bit about throwing the front office under the bus. Quote, the only way it's going to be a quick fix is if you wave a magic wand at it and throw lots of money at it. Clearly, we're not doing that. I'll go back to this. Every single game we go into, whether it's Nani, or whether it's Rooney, or whether it's Acosta, every single week, there are players in this league making a difference, and the gap in quality is huge. There are teams with a lot more quality than us, and that's what we're competing against, and no one talks about it. That is a really damning quote all around. It's basically, you know, the first quote is, my back line is crap, and I can't win with this team. And the second quote is, Porrick Smith set me up to fail, and I'm out here taking bullets from the fan base and, you know, jackass media pundits like Matt and Mark, and I'm out here all alone, man. It's not my fault that you gave me Kofi Opare off the scrap heap at the center back position, and it's not my fault that I had to cut a TAM level midfielder last year because he didn't want to play, and I had to cut my DP striker because he was hot garbage on a stick and hadn't shown up healthy in 2 years. Those are on some level legitimate criticisms. I'm obviously filling in the gaps. But those are on some level legitimate criticisms. However, you don't get very far as a coach by blaming your problems on somebody else. Anthony Hudson has not very often stood up and said, boy, I really am not, you know, I'm not really adjusting to MLS well. Or it's on me, this last loss. The only time he ever did it, to my strong recollection, was when they went to NYCFC last year and got blown out, because they came out to attacking and they got hammered.
Poor game plan. I think he used the phrase, you know, I don't want to say lambs to the slaughter, but, you know, the game plan, the tactical game plan from the start was set up to fail.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, I don't know. It's so, okay, so here's the interesting thing. It's an interesting question as to, so the interesting question is, one of the interesting things to say is that the original question that was asked was basically like, how'd you set up? You know, what'd you see in the defense? What'd you see in the offense? Why'd you struggle to score? And Anthony Hudson very clearly pivoted away from the original question to a different answer. And the answer felt like it was premeditated, which is a great question for the
yeah,
two.
Yeah, it was very Bob Bradley in the sense that I'm going to briefly address your question and then talk about what I want to talk about from the match.
It was a politician's trick, which is I'm going to answer the question that I want to answer, or really I'm just going to use this as my statement moment, which is really interesting, Matt, because the question becomes like, what's going on either behind the scenes or in Anthony Hudson's head that he felt like this was the week after 44 games at the helm, or 43 games at the helm of the Colorado Rapids, where he said, I need to say something that I've never said before, which is my players are crap and that's why we're losing and the front office is partly to blame and hasn't given me the players. There are a couple possibilities. One is he knows things have gone really poorly and he needs something to shake things up for the players. Two is, he is starting to just speak the truth now for a lot of reasons. One of them could be that he's not feeling fear. And the third is related to the first two, which is floating around on the internet as a theory that he's imminently about to be fired and that this was just
a Hail Mary effort to try and.
I wouldn't even say that. No. I would say he's gonna get fired this week and he knows this is the last time he's ever gonna be captured on a microphone. So he needs to get the thing off his chest that he needs to say, which is, I know I'm about to get fired and you're all gonna blame me. And that's, people are gonna think that my firing is gonna change things. But guess what? It's not, because the front office is lousy and the back line is lousy and that's not my fault. That's a really interesting theory, and we'll wait a couple days to find out if it plays out. The only thing I want to say about that, Matt, is if that's what happens, I'm going to be irritated because I've already written half of my column for this week and I'll have to throw it away.
And I'm going to be irritated because, you know, we know, okay, game's on a Friday. That means we have to really release Wednesday at the earliest. A friend and I, of mine, scored tickets to the Avs, game three game, which is tomorrow, Tuesday, April 30th. So Monday was really the only night we could record. And we, in the history of this podcast, we've been lucky compared to others in the MLS and the sports space where, you know, they record roughly weekly in accordance with the schedule, depending on the support. The sport that they cover, and then they record something and immediately the next day or by the time it gets released, it's obsolete with something completely crazy that's going to happen. So like, you know, the ultimate thing for us is that we release this and then, you know, something drastic happens with the club, you know, like tomorrow at 10 a.m. and then this entire conversation is rendered moot.
I don't see that happening because, and I think this is an interesting also para-diversion tangent off of the original one, although we could go on tangents of down this rabbit hole for another 2 hours, which we will not, dear listeners, I promise. But one question that I was thinking of off the top of my head, based on a conversation I was having on Twitter, is when's the optimal time to make changes in your front office or in your coaching staff? And the answer is certainly not in March, April, and May. Like, no matter what, especially in Major League Soccer. In the English League, it sometimes makes sense because you want to hire, hypothetically, a Sam Allardyce, you know, rescue you from relegation type specialist. You know, you parachute Big Sam in for the last 10 games of the season to pick out the most pragmatic setup possible to save some points and keep your team afloat, right? That doesn't exist in Major League Soccer. There's no point in keeping your team afloat. A mid-season change that's only going to last through the end of the year is totally pointless in a season, in a team like this. So when do you want to make changes? You want to make changes when either you can look for other coaches and other, hypothetically, if you're talking about changing general managers where you can look for other general managers, that's not right now because you have to wait till the English seasons have all played out and people have been let go or retained. And even early May, mid-May, June is still too early, really, because you have months and months of soccer to go. When the Rapids got rid of Pablo Mastroianni, they waited till August. I thought that was a pretty decent decision, and even that's a little early. Ideally, you let a guy play a whole season, and then you get rid of him. The only reason you don't do that last comment, Matt, is season ticket holders. Is that if you're trying to get people to buy season tickets, and you're trying to give them an exciting reason why they should come out and see the Rapids next year or re-up for 2020, you can't wait until September and October with this current coach and with the same lineup of players if you're in dead last. Like, you know, you call up a – if you're a ticket rep for the Rapids – and you call up a fan and say, are you going to re-up for 2020? Any sane ticket holder will say, why? They've been terrible for 3 years and you guys haven't changed a damn thing.
Mm-hmm. No. So a couple of comments on, you know, annotating what Hudson said. I know a lot of people have been blaming this person. This is someone that is, you know, not someone who's well-liked in Rapids fates. I said this last year when we had our, MLS salary episode, Mark, you can't blame any of this on Stan Kroenke. You know, based on the numbers that we had from last year, the Rapids were the 10th highest spending team in terms of total, player compensation from last year. And so, okay, you take out, you know, the two big exits as far as contracts concerned, you know, from last year were Stefan Aigner and then, Yannick Bolli. And you replace that, you know, with Kellen Acosta getting a pretty decent raise. And then you also have Benny Fellhaber, who at the very least is probably a max budget player and probably on TAM. And then Kai Kamara, who based on all reports, you know, is about at the same salary level that Yannick Bolli was. You know, it's firstly, and, you know, it comes out in a wash. Maybe it's slightly more. Maybe it's slightly higher. Okay. So, you know, you're the 12th highest spending team out of 24 teams, or maybe you're the 8th or the 9th highest spending team out of it. And okay, you want to say that the, you know, the Skelshengashi salary for the 2019 season is a sunk cost, but it's still one that the Rapids paid, and the ones that the Rapids knew about last summer when they could have potentially offed him or made another move, so to speak. So on some level, that money has to be included in that number, because it's been accounted for by the technical staff, because the technical staff had an opportunity to get out from under it, and they chose to do so until the absolute last possible date, because they thought that that was worth more than trying to get an international roster spot from the New England Revolution for like 150 in GAM and TAM combined. Okay? So, you can't blame Stan Kroenke, because he invested more money, and this is a mid-table team in terms of spending. This is a team in a roster that is not playing to the sum of their parts and is not playing to the sum of the money that's been invested in them. And this is also a team that has spent a lot of money on defense. They've got two 10-level center backs who cost an international roster spot each, who have been largely busts. And at this point, the only reason Danny Wilson's probably going to be back next year is because he's on a guaranteed contract. And I think at this point, it's going to have to take a Herculean effort, almost as good as him captaining New Zealand to a World Cup, for, I think, Tommy Smith to have his option for 2020 picked up. So, you know, this is a team that has spent a lot on defense and is absolutely terrible. At least when the Rapids had an average defense, you know, it was a bunch of budget players, and it was Bobby Burling, who, you know, was 1 year too old, and it was Axel Schuberg, who was just getting used to playing defense professionally, and it was Mark Birch, who didn't have any more pace left, and it was, you know, a cast of characters who, you know, were slightly miscast at the right back position, and it was a couple of goalkeepers, you know, who were domestic players who were making $150,000, and, you know, at one point it was, you know, Clint Irwin, who was contemplating going back to grad school and quitting soccer, who was, you know, living out of his car in North Carolina 2 years prior to that. You know, at the very least, you could say when the team had an average defense and was bad, they didn't have any money to spend. The DPs that they had were not remotely close to what the NYCFCs and the New York Red Bulls and the Seattle Sounders and the LA Galaxies were bringing in. And you had, you know, an island of cheap misfit discount toys on the back line, and Pablo Mastroeni duct taped that together into something that was a remotely average defense. And the new regime came in and spent a whole bunch of money and hasn't done anything. So I agree with Anthony Hudson there. The next question that I would pose to that, to your point, Mark, about him, you know, possibly throwing the front office under the bus is, up until this season, you know, everything that I heard when I asked Porrick Smith about Anthony Hudson or vice versa was they talk every day. They're in almost as much communication, you know, during the week, certainly in the off season, they're in the office, you know, burning the candle at both ends, every single day. You know, the only people on the technical staff who Hudson talks to more regularly than Porrick Smith are immediately his coaching staff. And that's because Porrick doesn't have to be out there for training every single day. And he's not physically out on the sidelines during game and practices and scrimmages.
Yeah. And I'm with you about the they talk every day thing. I actually, you know, you could speculate as to whether this interview marks a rift between the coach and the general manager. I know from hearing folks inside the Rapids staff that Porrick Smith is fairly sanguine about what hasn't gone right. And he is the first to admit that some folks did not work out and that is on him, right? Like I know for a fact that he recognizes that Yannick Bolli was a miss. I know for a fact that he knows that Stefan Aigner and Schelzengashi are on him, you know, not that they were necessarily foreseeable, but that's when the general manager makes a decision to get a player and they don't work out, that he takes the responsibility. Like Porrick Smith knows that. And I think we've heard him say, have quotes to that effect. Like, so I don't think Anthony Smith is fully quote unquote throwing Porrick Smith under the bus, like in a way that is shocking and, you know, like, oh my God, stop the press. But that being said, it was a little bit surprising because we've never seen a quote like that before. And it is possible that there is a rift there, and it is possible that, you know, there will start to be knives coming out and folks turning against each other within the Colorado Rapids staff, which that's a bad sign in April.
So my next question that I have to that question, and maybe this is rhetorical, and, you know, I'm going to assume even if I ask them in his face, I know what I'm going to get, and it's not going to be, you know, a coherent, true, well-versed answer. You know, I guess now the question I have after them being such a united front, such on such the same page, to where, you know, there were clearly a couple of signings that were Anthony Hudson's doing, or that he were clearly guys that he wanted. There were clearly ones that either Porrick and the coaching and the scouting staff had come up with, or the various analytical metrics that they particularly care about, players that they identified that were from regions where they had contacts, to where they could get more anecdotal information and at a reasonable price point for them. So I guess my next question to that point of, you know, okay, then who's signing these guys? If you're complaining about the defense, okay, the only two, as we talked about it, the only two incumbent defenders on this team that weren't a Porrick Smith as general manager while Anthony Hudson was the head coach signing were Axel Schuberg, who 2 years prior was a defender of the year nominee and finished second. And then the year before, those two came together and, you know, formed their dynamic duo, excuse me. You know, it would have been Court Ford, who was, a rookie of the year candidate on a very, very bad defensive team. Those were two players who proved to be very competent center backs in MLS in the right system. And they've come in and added every single other player who has had bad moments. We'll put an asterisk to the, you know, the homegrowns who in their first calendar year of MLS, because they're homegrowns and they're teenagers and they don't know what they're doing. And they're more for the future. But I mean, you know, you signed Declan Wynn and Danny Wilson and Tommy Smith, and then Hudson comes in and he says, hey, Axel, you're a bench player now for those three guys who've now effectively played them out of the right to be in MLS. Two of those players are making significantly more than Axel Schuberg. At one point, all three of those players were costing international roster spot. Axel at the time did, when he joined the team, because he was a Swedish international. He no longer does because, because he has his green card. And so I just, like, how do you rationalize that? So, oh, okay, Anthony Hudson, I'm going to go to you. Okay, Tommy Smith was a Kiwi. Declan Wynn was a Kiwi. Let's throw in Kip Colvey is there. Were those purely Porik Smith signings saying, hey, we want to sign this guy. You have a rapport with him. What do you think? And then you just said, okay. Like, I have a hard time. Like, at some point, this is a significant indictment of somebody in the front office and somebody in the team. And I'm not convinced that, you know, that blame pie should all go exclusively to, Porik Smith or people who aren't named Anthony Hudson. So on some point, like, these were your guys. How many of these guys came in and were Pablo Mastroeni guys? You shipped out all of them. Dominic Baggio isn't the starting forward for this team. Marlon Hairston isn't here anymore. Bobby Berling's not here. You didn't keep Alan Gordon around. You know, okay.
Jared Watts is gone.
You know, I won't blame Hudson for this, but okay. Pork got rid of two Pablo guys who were the embodiment of hashtag keep fighting in Sam Cronin and Mark Birch, who I've written, you know, effectively a full PhD soccer thesis now about how that completely doomed the 2017 season. You know, like at some point, okay, like if I genuinely want to go back and look at those quotes and understand their relationship, in which is Hudson just being was Hudson purely this whole time just accepting the guys that Porik was giving him, and is this roster entirely Porik's doing, and in that, is it more all on him rather than the what Hudson's done with the pieces he's been given? Because prior to this year, it seemed like a united front where there was a mutual agreement and a simultaneous signing off from both of them on all of the players they signed. And in that, this was a team you constructed. And in that, you ultimately looked at Tommy Smith and Danny Wilson and Jack Price and said that they were worth TAM level investments, and they have not played up to that level. And let's throw in Kellen Acosta as well, because he hasn't been effective at all. And the only guys who you've really signed who've proven to be effective in their first year were guys that you already had a really good track record with in MLS, and Benny Fellhaber and in Kai Kamara. So, you know, again, I have to ask, okay, you're blaming the players. Well, who's signing the players? And in that, there has to be on some level an indictment of you or your relationship with your general manager.
Yep. Yeah.
All right, shall we move on, Mark? We've gone long on this topic.
Well, this topic is the whole season, which is unfortunately, and it's also like the most popular topic on Twitter, which is like, who's to blame for the mess that is the Colorado Rapids? And more importantly, did somebody actually start to say it out loud? It's legitimately the thing that if you're the kind of person who only skips around to the parts of our podcasts that are, you know, unique or hot takey or interesting, it's the one you want to skip to for this week.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So Mark, we are currently for the Colorado Rapids, we are 9/34 through the 2019 MLS season. It can't get over fast enough. The Colorado Rapids are sitting in 12th in the Western Conference, and in the Supporter Shield, they are 24th last in Major League Soccer. They still have 2 points out of 9 games played. That's 7 losses and 2 draws, a negative 12 goal differential. They'll be taking on the second worst team in MLS this Friday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. That's a 7 p.m. kickoff, and that will be the Vancouver Whitecaps, who have 6 points off of a win, 5 losses and 3 draws, and a negative 5 goal differential. It should be said that the Vancouver Whitecaps have 3 losses and just 1 tie on the road in 2019. The Whitecaps are a very different team from last year. Mark Dos Santos, Mark with a C, not Mark with a K, it came from the being an assistant coach under Bob Bradley at LAFC. This is his first head coaching job in MLS, and they have jettisoned in excess of the majority of minutes that were played by starters for the team in 2018. Alfonso Davies has left for Bayern Munich. They've jettisoned out a whole bunch of other veteran players. Zach McMath, former Colorado Rapid, is backing up Maxime Crapeau, who's a Canadian goalkeeper. Eric Godoy and Daniil Henry are their two main center backs that they have. Their big acquisition right before the season started was Ali Adnan, who is an Iraqi international, 25 years old. I assume good buddies with Justin Miram. They normally play in a 4-3-3. Their big attacking acquisition this offseason was Awang Ing Boem from South Korea. He is 22 years old. Yordi Reyna is their main danger man in the attack. He's a Peruvian, very, very deadly against the Rapids. Last year in the game at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, Freddie Montero's kind of been in and out of the lineup. Coming back to the club, Colombian international, spent a bunch of time with the Sounders, and then was in Portugal, I want to say, with one of the Lisbon clubs off the top of my head. This is a team that has some speed and attacking flair, lots of 3 and 4 skill players if they were a FIFA team, but not a lot of finishing, not a lot of ideas, Mark, and still a team that's very much in flux defensively. Like Hudson likes to say, Mark Dos Santos is definitely playing for the long rebuild, and this was very much Dos Santos taking a bunch of flyers on some known quantities for him, seeing whether or not they could stick in MLS, and this is definitely a team that's willing to take one or two step forwards back this year in favor of the future. In that, Mark, this is a very bad team. This is a team that, if you want to make the playoffs, you should be able to beat at home. Mark, very briefly, what do you see in the Vancouver Whitecaps? What do you see in this matchup?
I don't see a lot in the Vancouver Whitecaps in the sense that I don't think the Colorado Rapids are playing anymore against other teams. I think they play against themselves at this point. That they need to rebound from a lot of losses. 6, I believe you said. They're rebounding a little bit from playing with a completely different tactical plan, which is not that big a deal. You know, teams change tactics from game to game generally, but it's a little harder when you lose. When you play with one tactic and you lose and you change tactics and you lose and you try to come back to your old tactic. So I'm assuming they come back in the diamond. I'm going to assume that they're going to come back with their regulars starting 4 in the middle, roughly. I don't know who's going to be on the back line since nobody's been effective. I did think that Sam Nicholson was very effective in his role, but he doesn't fit neatly into the diamond the way he did, before. Although you could play him as the underneath striker, you could play him as the top of the diamond number 10. You could do some fun things with Sam if they let him. For me, it's more about what the Rapids are going to do. I definitely think, it's important for Colorado to, get a hand on, the player on Vancouver who is most likely to be dangerous, although he disappears from game to game, and that's Jordi Reyna. That being said, the rest of his team is quite the mystery. I mean, you spelled it out pretty well, but there's a ton of turnover on this team. Not only is there a ton of turnover, but I was looking at this before. This team has more squad rotation than almost any other team I've seen in the league. Guys like Andy Rose and Derek Cornelius and Scott Sutter and Lucas Venuto and PC, who's a Brazilian with a different name, but he goes by PC, and Felipe and Russell Tybert and blah, blah, blah. I mean, like, they've got a long list of guys with 2 starts, 3 starts, 4 starts, 5 starts. So you just don't know who Mark Dos Santos is going to go with. You don't really know exactly what their formation's going to be, although they've been 4-3-3 and 4-4-2 a bit this year. And you know, he likes to play, he's a disciple of Bob Bradley. So he likes to play beautiful soccer, except when he wants to play pragmatic soccer. But I think this is a very, it's an interesting matchup that I don't think Vancouver is any one thing yet. I think they're still molding their identity, and Colorado is trying to recover. And it'll be a little bit about mentality. It'll be a lot about leadership. You know, after a week, you know, to finish the thought, after a week in which the coach has said something that might not go down very well in the locker room, after a week, the week before that, Benny Fellhaber said something pretty incendiary, which was basically said, yo, we're doing it up here. We're generating chances and we're scoring goals, but the back line needs to do its part. You know, I gotta wonder, like, how's the locker room right now? Who's showing leadership? Are people getting along? You know, is somebody going to be able to step up to the back four? I mean, this is a different question. And I know we're back to being off topic again, but another question that you could reasonably ask is, one of the challenges of having 2 really young fullbacks in Sam Vines and Sebastian Anderson is that they don't show leadership. They can't show leadership. They're kids. They're there to learn and absorb. So who's on the back line saying, yo, we got this, guys. You know, here's what you got to do. You've got to be fierce. You've got to be like, there's Tommy Smith probably is doing it, but he hasn't earned the right. I mean, I'm sure Tim is doing his best, but you know, Tim's probably exasperated at this point. It's really difficult. It's really difficult.
No, I think I wonder how that's going to play over against the Jordy Reyna is going to be somewhere in attacking position. It could be central or all over the place. Wong Enbom, you know, is going to play in the midfield. Maybe the three players defensively who've locked down their position. Danilo Henry, who's been a pretty solid mobile defender. And then, you know, has been pretty decent in the air. They spent a bunch of money on Ali Adnan, so he has to play well. And maybe the one guy from last year who I really like, Jacob Nowinski, has been pretty solid for them defensively. Kind of like a right back younger version of, Jordan Harvey with LAFC is probably a good comparison. You know, there's definitely some Mark Birch in him as well. But other than that, you could, every single other position for me is up in the air, and any formation that has flexibility within the personnel I just named is up in the air. I'm curious to see, because we've seen a little bit of rotation from the goalkeeper position when things have been chaotic scheduling wise, having a Friday game and then also having him play his former team that maybe he's a little bit familiar with them. Maybe we see Zach McMath in this game. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. But you know, I think Vancouver's gonna come in, they're gonna counter and bunker, they're gonna give the Rapids the ball. This is a defense and a team that can absolutely be had, but this is also a team that has enough speed in the attack to where they're gonna be able to victimize the Rapids. And I don't think there's a single defender on the Colorado Rapids right now who's healthy and able to play 90 minutes on Friday who I'd like in a 1v1 matchup against Jordy Reyna. That is a almost guaranteed goal for me for the Vancouver Whitecaps, and in that, Vancouver is going to play to protect their biggest weakness and then is also going to play in a position that is going to allow them to take advantage of the Rapids' biggest weakness. But in that, there's not going to be a lot of resistance for the Rapids to get the ball and get them into good positions. I think this is a game tailor-made for just, you know, try and battering ram it with Kai Kamara. And, you know, I'm gonna say something crazy here. Maybe I've been drinking too much Craven Cottage Kool-Aid over the course of the weekend, but I'm gonna say 1-0 the Rapids, and I think this is purely going to be effort and Kai Kamara wanting to say screw you to his former team. 1-0 yeah. Rapids, Kai Kamara on the goal.
Yeah, I think a win is definitely possible. One last thing on why I would think that this team can win this game is that, call me naive, call me a schmuck, call me whatever you want, but I don't think this team is historically bad levels of MLS bad. I mean, there's too much talent on this field. We have not seen the best of multiple players. The only player we've seen the best of is Kai Kamara. Kai Kamara has been regular metronome self of show up at the back post and ram that sucker home with his head. But guys like Benny Fellhaber, who've got over the top balls that will just feather in perfectly. Cole Bassett's got a shimmy shake move that he deployed more last year as a rookie than he has this year. Nicholas Mesquita has got to show up at some point this season. Sam Nicholson still
getting also against his former team.
Sam Nicholson still getting in gear off his injury. And then last but not least, I mean, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, then it turned out I was wrong, and now it turns out maybe I'll eventually be right. You know, if not this week, but, you know, in 3 to 4 weeks, 5, 6, who knows, they will get Courtney Ford back, and God willing, the guy will just come out and wreck shop. I mean, that would be, you know, the best mid-season trade the Colorado Rapids could ever hope for is Court Ford. But point is, this team hasn't shown what it's capable of, and they're, you know, if they can get Dylan Serna back on the field as a starter anywhere, and get him doing his electric thing, Diego Rubio, you know, can put guys on their back all the time. I mean, you know, this team's got weapons. They just need to believe a little bit, and Vancouver's a team they could do it against.
I don't think we got an official score prediction for you, Mark, on this game.
They're gonna win. That's all I got. I mean, I like to think that Colorado can't not give up. They're going to give up two goals a game. So 3-2 is a good bet, but 3-1, 2-1, all of those higher scores possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the last thing I'll say, this is something I've said on Twitter and something I think I said previously in writing and on this podcast, if the Rapids end up losing this game, I will officially call for them to be the favorites to win the Wooden Spoon. And I think we're both at this point, Mark, where it's gonna have to take, many millions of dollars and a magic wand, I think, for this team to turn into a playoff team this year. But I will if the Rapids lose on Friday, I will guarantee that they will be 2019 Wooden Spoon winners in air quotes.
I think that's for sure.
All right, Mark. Let's go to the NASCHCHL. This is an email we got a couple of weeks ago from Andrew Foster. First email NASCHCHL he sent. Really long email. I'll get to the gist of the questions that he's asking. Having spent the past couple years immersing myself in the game, I'm curious about the makeup of the fan culture of the Colorado Rapids. The team, since the 2010 MLS Cup season, has had many lackluster seasons with very few bright spots in between. They haven't given us much hope for. Our supporters always entirely dismissive of the architecture that we are witnessing now, has there always been a general dissatisfaction with the team from the front office to forward? Why is it that I am, quote, polishing a turd, end quote, when I attempt to break down the nuances of the state of the PIDs? It seems a vast portion of the supporters community refuses to see the forest through the trees. We can't deny the losses, question the coaching staff, the front office. But I see the scaffolding, and I see some pieces are in place. I am tired of the gatekeepers drowning out interesting discussion in favor of disgust. He's fake quoting here. I've been a season ticket holder since 06, and I'm not giving this team another dime. I don't want to hear it. End quote. So I think we can throw in, the Hudson out group in this, Mark. I think we can throw just the nihilist comments that we get on various social media platforms on this. And certainly towards the end of the year, you always get the very loud minority of the, I just decided I'm not renewing my season tickets anymore. Talk about the fan culture, talk about the current state of the team and where this nihilism and negativity and just immediate presumption of doom is fostering from, and how we can maybe be a little bit more healthy or just, try and see the forest through the trees if the fan base is indeed not seeing it.
There's a lot to this question, and what I'm going to take out of this question is how reactive to results is the fan base? And so I'm going to slice that up a little bit, which is the Rapids have a not unique fan base, but a specific fan base as opposed to other teams in Major League Soccer. Colorado is an old school MLS 1.0 team, which means that, and I've talked to the marketing director, so I know that my idea is mostly on track with what the team has noticed in terms of when they survey, which is a significant population of the fans are Colorado generic sports fans who are coming out to one or two Rapids games a year because they're the local sporf team and you support your sporfing. A significant number of the fans are the soccer mom, soccer dad, soccer kid, right? You're a soccer player, you're a soccer family. The best soccer team in town, the team with the professionals, the way to see Zlatan and Rooney is you go out to see the Rapids. Some of those convert to season ticket holders and some don't. But those fans tend to be fairly loyal and results don't matter that much, which is really interesting. And that's from a book called Soccernomics. It's the right age to take your family to the sporfing game. It's the right age to take your kid out for soccer. Soccer's his favorite or her favorite sport right now. So that's what you go and see. And if the Rapids are bad, it doesn't matter. If the Rapids are good, it doesn't matter because you're 45 years old, you have disposable income, and your kid has shin guards. And that's why you go to the Rapids. And so ideally in that 3-year window or 5-year window, you see some success and you build lifelong soccer supporters. And if you don't see success, then you don't convert to a lifelong soccer supporter. And after 2 or 3 years of badness, you quit. The last thing, the last section that's worthy of talking about, although there's a fourth section that's a whole nother ball of wax, is supporter culture. The Rapids have the weakest kind of millennial, under 35, single male, single female support. They have the worst of that of almost any team in Major League Soccer, with the exception of probably Chicago. And maybe also Dallas and Houston. And the reason for that is twofold, maybe threefold, threefold. One is location, right? They're not ideally suited to be near where those people live, although more and more young people are moving out towards that part of town as the neighborhoods around Commerce City are getting cooler. Two is results. The team hasn't been very good, and so the millennials aren't excited about it because it's hurt C38 and their ability to be exciting and fun and dynamic because fewer people show up. So location, results, and investment, I think, is the last one, which is, you know, Colorado has good advertising, but not great advertising, and they would need to step it up a lot more in order to capture millennials and to be a lot more innovative and creative. The last group that I'm not going to talk about is Latino outreach, and Latino fans are never gonna.
We've been banging that drum almost the entire existence of this podcast.
Right, but also, you know, it goes back to one of the other things we've talked about, or that the question comes to, which is, are Latinos going to come out and support a terrible Rapids team when they could just stay home on a Saturday night and watch the team that they grew up on, which is Tigres or America or Cholos or, you know, whoever is your favorite Liga MX team. If I was a native Spanish speaker, or Spanish was my second language, I grew up Latino in Denver, I don't know why I would root for the Rapids. Their penetration to the Latino market isn't very good, and watching Mexican soccer is better and more fun. So I get it, but those are the ways in which the fan base has been seriously affected by the fact that the team isn't spending the money on being better. Long answer, but it's a tough question. And, you know, money and success will turn things around, and possibly a downtown stadium. But, you know, a lot of people in Rapids message boards think that the panacea to the whole problem is, we'll just build a downtown stadium and everything will be fine. And my answer is no, it won't. You know, you could build a downtown stadium. You know, we're going to find out with Orlando. You know, they built a brand new stadium. It's gorgeous, and they're crap, and they were crap last year. And if they don't get good if they go another 2 years without being good, then they'll be a very new, very empty stadium in Major League Soccer.
No, I agree with you, Mark. You know, it was the last, you know, I want to say the last 2 months of the season last year for Orlando. You know, you could see Orlando spelled out in the gold seats with the purple background at kickoff, and, you know, pretty regularly. You know, I'm sitting up mostly in the press box, so I don't get as good of a view of seeing Colorado spelled out on the west side of the stadium, but it's pretty easy to mark out almost every single letter in Rapids on the east side of the stands. The one thing you didn't really touch on the millennial side of things is Colorado is, you know, sports, especially American sports, are definitely rooted in hometown and where you grew up, tribalism. And Colorado has a lot of transplants, and in particular the millennial cohort, the hipster young, you know, late, you know, mid-20s to early 30s period, that cohort has a greater percentage of transplants than any of the other major ones that we talked about that you mentioned. You know, it's not like there's a significant Hispanic transplant population that hasn't been here for a while, or that hasn't been caring about soccer for multiple generations. Or if they have, they're coming from Mexico, so then obviously they have their other, you know, they support that team from the home country, and in that's a connection to their culture. That to this point, I don't think a single team in MLS or soccer anywhere in America has done a good job of tapping into that or trying to recreate that with the Hispanic community. But the fact is, you know, I talk to a lot of people who are soccer fans. You know, I've got Red Bull's buddy who is a season ticket holder in section 121 in the South Ward, you know, who refers to drinking PBRs on match day as drinking BW PBRs, and he's a New York Red Bulls fan, and he goes to a Rapids game once every 2 years, and it's when they're playing the New York Red Bulls. The only areas where we've seen major transplant cities really tap into that millennial transplant genesis is with some other cultural phenomenon, like you had with Atlanta, that just literally steamrolled like a train into the league and had so many things interesting about it, from the stadium situation to the team to the style of play to being extremely competitive, to where you had people who were transplants who the team got them into soccer. And the Rapids haven't really done anything, and I include the 2010 MLS Cup run as well, to get that cohort into soccer. And then in particular, the people who of, you know, my cohort who were already into soccer were into soccer before they moved to Colorado, and in that they already had a team. Possibly they were a Euro snob, possibly an existing MLS team or somewhere else, maybe from a different country, that they were attached to, and the Rapids haven't been able to tap into that, or they're not going to be able to recreate that, and there's nothing they're doing that's going to achieve this regional cultural phenomenon that's going to tap into it. To your point specifically, Andrew, about where the nihilism and just the general negativity comes from, I just, you know, it's too many fans, I think, losing. Have just seen the
lots
go
of
ahead, Mark.
Losing.
Lots of losing.
Stop
and it's
losing.
And it's seeing the exact same script every single time. It's seeing big money players, whether it was Flabby Torres or whether it was the team hyping up Nana Boateng, I believe is the first TAM signing that the team had ever brought in internationally. You know, it's every single year there's somebody new, and they're not hyped up as a savior, but they're hyped up to be good, and then ultimately they're an absolute bust. Like, you could not have gone any lower for the amount of money that they were invested in them. You know, Mark, I'm currently reading what we think about when we think about soccer, and one of the really good quotes from that breaking down soccer on a cultural, societal, philosophical level of, it's not the losing that kills you. It's the hope that things will change, and then when things ultimately don't go that way, it's the hoping that, oh, maybe they'll figure things out, maybe this will be our year, and that they end up losing. And I think where the fan base is at, in terms of their nihilism, in terms of their, I've been a season ticket holder since 06, and I'm not giving this team another dime, I don't want to hear it. It's the fact, like, the thing that's so depressing about the Rapids right now is that there is no hope. There's nothing tangible to where you can look at this team. This team is objectively bad. It is obvious to anyone who is looking at it intelligently as a, even just a well-versed fan, to be honest. Not people like you and me, Mark, who obsess about this and break it down from an analytical and a statistical standpoint. You know, find me someone who, find me anyone anywhere in the league who watches at least 3 games a season, or 3 games a weekend example, is, you know, your standard, I'm going to watch my team, I'm going to watch the nationally televised games, and then maybe when I'm doing chores at some point on Saturday and Sunday, I've got ESPN Plus MLS Live on in the background. Find that person, have them watch 3 games in a row of the Colorado Rapids, and they're going to say, yeah, this team is bad, and they're going to point out 2 or 3 really obvious bullet points that you and I have dissected down to a T every single week on this show, and it's going to be extremely obvious to them. The thing that's depressing about this team is that they're losing, they're clearly bad, they're obviously very bad, and there's no indication that it's going to be any better.
Well,
this is the existence of the Colorado Rapids.
And that's this is like the setup for like the rest of the podcast later in the season and next year, which is that, like, the team has started the season with a lot of pundits, you know, around the league, including me and you, saying this team won't be very good until they can clear their DPs from Gashi and from Tim Howard and start over from there, which is kind of what Hudson said a little bit in his comments. But the reason, so a hopeful fan would say, okay, we can turn it around if we can just get 2 big signings. From Europe, some really great players. And for the more analytical fans, or for the fan you were talking about who's watched 3 games, they say, like, 2 guys is not going to fix the problem with the other 9. You know, like, there's problems at multiple positions where they're significantly they're just not good enough at many, many positions. And maybe the position that they're best at is striker right now, and that guy's 34 years old. You know, at some point, the wheels are going to fall off the bus for Kai Kamara. So so that's the challenge. That's the challenge of this team going forward.
And the track record that we have with the existing people in positions of power for the Rapids have a very, very terrible track record. There's no indication that if Porik's able to get some center back off the scrap heap before the spring, before the primary transfer window closes on May 7th, there's no anecdotal evidence from his prior track record with the Rapids that player is going to be significantly better or is going to be a starting center back caliber player. There's no indication in the timing or the financial investment or in how a player signing in the summer is going to get integrated in the squad that they're going to have a significant impact on the second half of the season, assuming there's still anything to play for this team. And there's no indication for the level of money that the Rapids are probably investing that it is going to be an immediately productive and high caliber DP either at the number 10 or the number 9 position who the Rapids are going to bring in. It's not the losing that kills you, it's the hope that kills you. And right now what's killing Rapids fans is that there is no hope.
And the team is so bad that you have to overpay those DPs an obscene amount of money to even get them to consider the team at this point, which is a whole nother conversation.
Yes, there's no indication that it's getting better any time soon. You know, it's the, you know, like the punch, like at this point, like the Rapids are becoming, you know, the punchline that was, you know, prior to the Odell Beckham trade this offseason, you know, the punchline that was the Cleveland Browns is their existence. You know, this is bad news Bears level ineptitude. And
yeah, we had that good year in 2016 though.
That in a lot of ways was a fluke and was extremely implausible to replicate, and is not something you can count on in MLS 3.0, and not something that would be extremely productive with the current roster right now, even if they had 9 Alan Gordons, Mark.
Fair point.
Yeah, so I mean, that's where, so to answer your, that's, I think, where the dismissiveness is coming from in all of this, Andrew. And I think that's where fans aren't interested in going down the rabbit hole and trying to see the forest through the trees. Because every single time they try to do it and try to cling on to that 1%, that little bit of hope, they've ultimately had their heart break in. And I think ultimately, you know, everybody's, you know, it's the morale, you know, beatings will continue until morale improves. And I think a significant portion of the fan base has just kind of decided, all right, I'm just going to lay down and take it because that's less effort and ultimately less disappointment than any of the other alternatives. Happiness is defined by expectations, and ultimately now I think a significant portion of the fan base has no expectations. Excuse me, I'm still getting over my cough. You know, they have no expectations, and in that they just resign themselves to the current state of the team and the fact that nothing's getting better anytime soon, and it's going to take a significant overhaul of the team. For a lot of fans, that means Anthony Hudson getting fired. For another good chunk of that group, it means you know, a jettisoning of Porik Smith and a lot of the other front office staff, and a significant roster turnover. And that means a commitment to another, you know, 2.5, maybe even 3-year rebuild. So even if you want to fire Hudson and Porik Smith right now and wait till 2020 when those contracts run out to appoint somebody, you're looking at 2020 being a rebuild and 2021 being a rebuild. You're not looking to be good until all of those things go right until 2022. And this is a fan base that has had, you know, 2 non-horribly suffering years in the last decade. And in that, I think everybody's just kind of, you know, they've just resigned themselves to the fate as it is. And, you know, in that they're numb to the disappointment. And that's where I think that's where the I've been a season ticket holder since 06 and I'm not giving this team a dime. I don't want to hear it. The fans don't want to hear it anymore because they've heard it so many times and they've seen the exact same thing. And so they're just, you know, they've seen this story before and they're not going to get caught up in anything or the nuances. They're just, they've accepted the beating and they're just going to sit there and take it. And this is your life now. This is your existence. Listeners, you can follow us on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at @LWSMattPollard. Check out our Rapids musings at the Denver Post and at Last Word on Soccer. Head on over to the denverpost.com / HTHL for a special deal on all of the Denver Post digital content, all of Jake Shapiro's work, all of Mark Goodman's work, and all the other things going on at the Denver Post, Rapids related, sports related, or otherwise. Check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Rapids96podcast, or you can search Holding the Highline. Hit us up on Twitter at Rapids96podcast. Send us your questions using the hashtag AskHTHL for anything longer than 280 characters. If you want to get in touch in a little bit more long form setting, feel free to email us, as Andrew did, at Rapids96podcast@gmail.com. Listeners, we will see you next week, where hopefully I am grinning with as much delight as I did walking to the Putney Bridge entrance after the game against Craven Cottage, and hopefully we have something to not be completely miserable about. Until then, Rapids more Gulas.